just bursts with violence. It's got every absurdity and nihilism of the world.
CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Vancouver. Every absurdity and nihilism of the world since 1937.
It'll play off-Broadway. I can see it now.
I just wanna talk shit and tell you everything that happened when I did get off. And did you really come when he went down? And if I'm not crazy when I return, would you be there? I just need a girl. Could you be there? I just need.
Hi everyone, I'm Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by the Accessibility Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam people. Today's episode contains potentially triggering content regarding medical assistance in dying and death. So today's we have a guest, Madeline. Madeline suffers from post-viral syndrome, which for her includes myalgic encephalomyelitis, or ME. ME is considered to be a neuroimmune disorder, and symptoms typically include extreme fatigue, various immune dysfunctions, and physical pain. So, Madeline, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, how are you doing today?
I'm having the morning of the comedy of errors, so I'm glad to be here, and I'm grateful for all the accommodation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. So can you tell us just a little bit about your story and your condition?
Sure can. I was 12 years old when I got my first round of mononucleosis. You know, the cute little kissing disease? Not so little. I used to have the immune system of a god. Before 12, I had one round of mild chickenpox, one serious flu, and that was it. Mm-hmm. After 12, it damaged my immune deficiency. I developed an immune deficiency, a series of infections, and then autoimmune disorders, and then a second round of mono when I was 30, and that disabled me. Mm-hmm. And I've struggled ever since, and we're going to talk more about that later. But due to the lack of supports within the medical system. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it has been really, really hard. This was not meant to be my journey.
Yeah, for sure. I hear you. So how long have you been living with this disability?
43 years. Well, 43 years is how long I suffer with post-viral disease. Mm-hmm. I pushed myself in university in ways I shouldn't have pushed myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm really grateful to talk to university students who may be suffering from post-viral disease and long COVID in particular, because I did things that directly led to my becoming disabled. So I've been disabled now for about 25 years, somewhere in there.
Okay. What are some symptoms that you experience as a result of post-viral disease and also your current disability?
It's a big disease that hasn't been properly parsed yet. And again, we're going to talk about that. There are some hallmarks that post-viral disease sufferers have. And one of the big ones is ME, myalgic encephalomyelitis. And one of the big hallmarks of that disease is what the term is still being used, although it shouldn't be, PEM, or post-exertional malaise. Mm-hmm. Now, malaise means afraid of getting sick. So it really indicates the bias. But what the symptom is that you can push yourself. I had one doctor refer to it as borrowing money from the mob. you can push yourself. Like today, I'm going to be pushing myself and I will pay for it. Mm-hmm. And so it's that there's some new terms, post-exertion neurological exhaustion or post-exertion symptom exacerbation. Mm-hmm. And so what can happen during that penne is that you can actually die. Your heart has the most mitochondria in the body. And these are, they should be parsed into families of disease, like cancer is parsed into families of disease. So these mm-hmm. mitochondrial, you know, the system can be damaged in a host of ways. And what can happen is your heart can just fail. Mm-hmm. My grandmother died at 50 with the bulk of my symptoms, misdiagnosed with nonspecific heart disease, mm-hmm. which I don't believe she had. She went out dancing with her husband the night before, and the next day she dropped dead. So that's kind of the heart and soul of how bad penne can be. Mm-hmm. ME patients who die don't tend to be listed in death certificates as ME. It tends to be heart attack. Mm-hmm. So we aren't getting the recognition. But that's one of the big ones. Autoimmune disorders, dysautonomia, POTS, fibromyalgia. All of these tend to be, you know, different combinations for different people.
Yeah.
They all afflict women at higher rates than men.
Yeah.
And so they have all been sadly dismissed and yeah. there hasn't been proper research yet. Again, we're going to talk
yeah,
about
that. Yeah, and we'll get into that yeah. in a later part. But I kind of want to talk a little bit about what life is like for you on a day-to-day basis.
I'm struggling to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling to stay alive. I found supports myself. I did research. I mean, I've read more research papers than most physicians ever will. I trialed and error in ways that I would never recommend anybody else mm-hmm. do, because you can exacerbate and deteriorate yourself. But I found supports for the immune deficiency, which deteriorated into I was getting infections in a cut in 3 hours. That increased my energy, decreased the POTS and the dysautonomia, but I can't afford them because they're mm-hmm. not in the system. And I can't get help for those. So I've been staying alive on a GoFundMe. And mm-hmm. so when I'm able to do my supports a little better, I'm able to function a little better, but I struggle to make meals. I struggle to clean. I struggle to get to appointments. I'm very socially isolated because it tends to go at the bottom of the pile, but I'm still doing community building work. But all of that has sort of been, you know, pushed and worsened by the fact I have to beg for my life on the internet on a GoFundMe, that I have to do a host of meetings with the government, although they've officially, like, shut the door. They don't want to deal with post-viral diseases. And now I'm going to be having to do a human rights case. And so all of that means that, do I have the energy to eat? Do I have the energy to shower? Like, I'll go, like, 6 weeks without washing my hair because... like, do I go to an appointment or do I wash my hair? It's like having a really tiny energy budget.
Yeah.
That kind of, I think, is the shortest way to try mm-hmm. to explain a very complex disease.
I have a question, if that's okay. You talked about community, and mm-hmm. I can only imagine your journey has been really lonely. And how has that been like? Have you been able to find other people who are living with similar conditions, and... have you found some community?
It's online. And sadly, as I've deteriorated, my dyslexia has collided with the ME and the fibro in ways that make textual communication really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incredibly isolating. ME patients tend to refer to ourselves as the millions missing, because we're just removed from society. And it becomes really hard for us to spend the energy on interacting. That said, I'm driven by purpose, and so I've built communication bridges between abled and disabled populations. I've done food security, you know, projects. So it's not like if people think, oh, like a PWD, it's just like, you know, person with a disability is just taking from the. It's like, well, I've created things no one else could create because I understood how things work. So
yeah.
You know.
That's awesome.
It is definitely a perspective that only someone who has walked a mile in your shoes would be able to understand. I recently read a book, actually, about dementia and how people with dementia are typically isolated from society in care homes. And there was a section of the book that talked about how this experience with dementia relates a lot to people who live with a disability. A lot of society tends to isolate people with disabilities from the world.
Well, you know, this actually leads me to a thought I wanted to talk about because I want to refer to mm-hmm. it again later. And it's a big part of my community building as well, because I don't look at the bureaucracy or the government or the general public as evil. Mm-hmm. And I don't look at like, oh, they don't care. I don't believe that at all. I believe there are two big ideas that if you understand them, you understand why PW prisons with disabilities have been abdicated on, why there's been allowed to be gender bias continuing. One is, it's called the Semmelweis reflex. And way back at the turn of the century, there was a doctor in a maternity ward who they just had catastrophic death rates of the young mothers. But the midwives weren't having that. And so he went to the midwives and he examined them and realized they were washing their hands. So he got all of his staff to wash their hands, and their death rates dropped. So we thought, this is great. I'm going to write a paper. So we wrote a paper and was crucified, drummed out of his profession. And you think, well, why? So the Semmelweis reflex, the definition is a reflex-like tendency to reject new evidence or new knowledge because it contradicts established norms, beliefs, or paradigms. And that leads to the next idea is why? Why? So you've got Antonio Damasio, who's a world-famous neurologist, a neuroscientist. I highly recommend reading some of his papers. He says we are feeling machines that think. But because we believe we are thinking machines that feel, we don't understand that we make our decisions 95% of the time based on emotion. And so what also happens when you believe you're a thinking machine that feels is you believe your experience is the empirical experience, rather than we all have islands of experience and we must build communication bridges and find out where we're similar and where we're different. And we also don't understand the dark, dark underbelly, because it's a great evolutionary tactic in so many ways. Empathy is, as Gloria Steinem said, is the revolutionary emotion. But if you don't understand that you are vulnerable to bias, then you are not using critical thinking to work beyond it. So you're getting into people thinking like, oh, I would be different. I would try harder. I would pray more, or I would vision board it away, or I would, you know, they must have done something wrong. It must be karma, versus like, oh, wait a minute. This could happen to me. This could happen to me. So I feel like those two ideas allowed me to do community work no one's ever been able to do. It allowed me to talk to bureaucrats right up to ministers. I spoke to the Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction. I spoke to the Senior Ministerial Assistant of Health, and all kind of host of bureaucrats in between. And I had one of the bureaucrats at SDPR say, you know, usually when someone deteriorates, you're, to your point, they're screaming at us. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you're not. It's like, no, what purpose does that serve? I know you're not evil, but there are systems in place that are not being self-recognized as being discriminatory and being gender biased. And so they're not being addressed.
We'll get a little bit more into those systemic biases later.
Absolutely.
But I kind of want to talk about like the reality of your life currently. So you can't work because of your disability, and living is very expensive, especially in a city like Vancouver. So the government currently gives people with disabilities a baseline of $1,358.50 in funding per month for single persons. So just kind of a statistic that I thought was interesting to mirror that one was CERB. If you remember CERB, that was some funding given to people who couldn't work during COVID, was more, which was around $2,000 per employed person. So would you like to talk a little bit about that disparity in funding?
Well, I think it's so much worse than even that. Mm-hmm. So way back, I had been volunteering, teaching meditation. I did that for about 10 years. I put one of my meditations up on the I Am Madeline Pod podcast. Mm-hmm. They had a government program for persons with disabilities to start a business. Now, I was hemorrhaging into debt at that point. The treatments I'd found, I was able to do at vastly lower amounts, and so they were less expensive. But back then, we were receiving like about $900 a month. And I almost was able to work. But if a disease isn't managed, you are not able to work. I could have been working. I could still be working if my disease was managed. So there's this like, oh, they're not working. But it gets worse. If you are a PWD on assistance that can work, you have better support. So during COVID, CERB was afforded to PWD who had been previously working. But PWD who couldn't work and were on assistance received a $300 bump from what was then $1,183. Mm-hmm. So there is a whole bunch of, I'm hoping not conscious, hurry up and die going on for persons with disabilities who can't work, but they're creating situations in which you have no possibility of doing that.
Yeah.
So
it's a system that's very much so not encouraging people with disabilities to thrive.
Well, yeah, creating situations in which it is impossible to do so. Mm-hmm. I've said again and again that the current PWD assistance supports and money are of an amount that if a healthy person were on them, they would become disabled, they would deteriorate and die early. Mm-hmm. So if you're already disabled, it is an assurance of an early death. It is an assurance of deterioration.
Yeah, I kind of want to talk a little bit about how much money the government is giving you for treatment. So we talked a little bit about
Zero.
This, but I looked into it a little bit. So assistance for some non-MSP covered treatment is nowhere near governing body rates for anything. Like, for example, you receive $23 for 10 sessions. So that's about $230 for all practitioners.
Yeah, but let's be clear about that $23. The $23 is the cost of administration of acquiring the $23. So either a practitioner takes you on as a charity case, or they don't take you on at all. They refuse you care because you can't earn a living on that. You know, we shouldn't be charities. And yet if I go to a specialist, they get paid $500 for 10 minutes. So they don't expect them to do that. Situations are created in which you cannot access treatments. $23 is ridiculous. I mean, you can't. I mean, $23 to spread among. And treatments that a healthy person might view as a luxury are, for me, like life-saving treatments, like physiotherapy. During the COVID-19 lockdown, I lost access to physio and the intravenous treatment that I do. And I stopped drinking. I stopped eating. I couldn't get up to do either of those. I started to have to keep protein bars in my bed and some water in my bed. It was taking me up to 8 attempts to stand up to go pee. I started getting adult diapers. I was worried I wasn't going to make it. And my pain got so bad that I woke up hearing somebody crying and thinking, like, who's crying? And as I, became more conscious, realizing I was crying in my sleep. The pain was so severe. Mm-hmm. And it took after, I'm very lucky that I have a physio who's willing to deal with that. She didn't want me to die. But many people can't access that. It shouldn't be like that. When it didn't used to be like that. There were supports that were taken away from us about 18 years ago.
Yeah. We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the crux of MAID.
Okay. Sounds good.
The milk is sour. I've barely been to college and I've been doubtful of all that I've dreamed of. The brink of my
second show added. MRG Live presents Haley Hendricks at the Biltmore Cabaret on April 19th. Haley Hendricks is a rising star in the indie folk scene. Her unique voice and intricate guitar playing will leave you spellbound. Don't miss the chance to see Haley Hendricks perform live at the Biltmore Cabaret. Tickets available at admitone.com.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial, open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Hi, welcome back. This is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by the Accessibility Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. So this episode has a trigger warning. It contains potentially triggering content regarding medical assistance in dying and death. So welcome back, Madeline.
Thank you.
So MAID, it stands for Medical Assistance in Dying, and it's a bill specific to Canada. Mm-hmm. So it was originally created as compassionate end-of-life care for those with foreseeable deaths or suffering. But it's since extended to really anybody with a disability, no matter how manageable. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how this is pretty problematic considering people with disabilities are not given adequate resources or support to live in a world that is not set up for those with disabilities. And I would like to kind of preface this by saying that Madeline and I were discussing earlier, we are not against MAID. What MAID has done has just highlighted a lot of issues within how disabilities are treated in society. But MAID absolutely has a time and place. It's just not this one. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about MAID and what your thoughts on it are.
I obviously can best talk about my experience. And I feel like I don't want to presume to speak about anybody else's experience, but I do feel like my experience is much more universal than people really want to recognize. I applied for MAID after I shook the last allopathic tree I could find. I was running through the last of $40,000 of debt. I knew exactly what was coming for me. I saw what happened to grandma. I saw what happened when I tried to reduce my treatments. And when I applied, I had a physician that was one of the first physicians I ever met who almost finished my sentence and said, because I said, I know where I'm going, to not be able to move or speak or eat, to be trapped in my body in a poverty care home bed, not able to connect or have purpose or community. And she had seen that death before. But she said she wasn't allowed to label it as foreseeable death. That's part of the abdication on the disease. But she said that when the law changed to foreseeable to quality of life, then she could approve it because, you know, that my pain levels are never below a 7 ever. But that's not why I applied for MAID. It's this bricking of the mitochondrial system that's going to be just one of the slowest and most brutal deaths if my heart doesn't just straight up fail right out of the gate. And I was terrified of that slow death. So for me, MAID is not a life and death choice, because that I think is the big misunderstanding, especially on quality of life. It's like, oh, they're choosing. It's like, no, I've been forced into a situation in which it's what kind of death. And I've read some articles about, and they seem to be predominantly women, and they seem to be predominantly with diseases that afflict higher rates than men. I saw a multiple chemical sensitivity person with that, an article about that, and EDS, which I also have. I'm staying upright with a back brace right now. And these are manageable diseases. These are manageable diseases, but ME is so not managed that it doesn't have a category of coverage under MSP. And even though the Finance Committee recommended it, again, they chose not to. So when you're looking at these larger issues of MAID, we've always been dying. Now we have an opportunity to choose what kind of death. But does this, like being forced off a cliff, adhere to human rights and anti-discrimination laws here in Canada? Absolutely not. And I think the big misconception in our country is that we have these laws. They would avail themselves of these laws. When I first started speaking to the media about 2 years ago, I was told by an advocate that there was a high probability that I would be retaliated against by the government, that I would be audited. And it's one of the reasons I hadn't spoken up. I'd heard of that happening before. So there is a quelling of that. And it's also, for me to do a human rights case, which I am going to do now that the government has just completely stonewalled post-viral disease, particularly ME, after me 3 years of trying to talk with them, it's going to take 5 years. How do I stay alive that long? How do I spend that kind of energy? When you're sick, especially with ME, you don't have energy for that. And I know listeners might be saying, well, she sounds really energetic. It's because I'm full of treatment. It's like if you took insulin away from a diabetic, what happens? It's a different biochemical disorder. But I have a biomechanical disorder, and you can see how I could be improved. But so MAID, as you said, Nicole, I'm not against it. I do think that the spirit of MAID is not being adhered to. I'm deeply concerned about expanding it to mental illness in minors, because I think this is really like, oh, well, if we kill PWD when they're young, they won't cost the system money. Like, this is a specious conversation. It's pretending to be logic when really it's all about this bias I was talking about, this being a feeling machine that thinks, and this Semmelweis reflex going on. The cost of deteriorating into wanting or needing MAID are either equal to or way more. So I think we need to start making decisions about who we really are, because this discrimination has been going on for always. When I first was on PWD assistance, the measure of pressure is you were audited every year like you were a criminal. And then that same government that came in and took supports away decided that they must be tricking the system. They made everybody redo their forms. People committed suicide, and nobody was found to be on PWD assistance who shouldn't be on PWD assistance. The cost of that was catastrophic. The cost of saying no to asking for an extra 23 visits, I loosely calculated it, was about five times what the actual support costs, and is not a real support. So we need to change how we view MAID. Does there need to be a safety, you know, like where a doctor goes like, well, this is a disease that afflicts women at higher rates than men. It doesn't have the funding. It doesn't have a category of coverage. I have a patient who found a treatment that with my eyeballs I can see is different. Like I should put them with this division that can sort of address this and begin to make changes. But we don't have anything like that. And I had somebody say like, oh, well, the MAID assessors should have blah, blah, blah. It's not their job. The MAID assessor's job is to assess where you are, and you know, and based on that, they are not given any other powers, nor do I think they should. It's not their job, and it's not fair to ask them to do that. But we don't have safety nets. We're not self-recognizing discrimination in the medical system, and I include that against persons with disabilities. I have had at least two GPs over the year who, when they found out that I was a person with a disability on assistance, refused to take me on. Mostly it wasn't overt. It was like, oh, my front staff, they were wrong. I wasn't taking patients. I mean, this is like to my face being said. Mm-hmm. And you can't fight back against it, especially as a woman, because you will be blacklisted in your file. And I found that out. I had been misdiagnosed as not having fibro. But at the beginning of the letter, I read many years later, like, oh, you know, Madeline is such a personable, you know, charming woman. And I'm like, why is that in my medical file? And if I wasn't, is that going in my medical file? Because we're discovering it is. And you will be blacklisted when other doctors, they'll think, oh, you're a problem child. So when I have doctors just bailing on me, not willing to look at my treatments, not willing to do actual science, because I feel like I'm like Oliver Twist begging, please, sir, can I have some science? And I know we're going to talk more mm-hmm. about that a bit later. But it's directly impacting MAID. And I know I right now I'm trying. I have enough money to stay alive till June. I'm going to be starting a human rights case without any ability to see it through right now. And so I'm just begging to stay alive. And I think here I'd like to take a moment and just, I know this is heavy to hear. I know this is difficult. I think most listeners understand that we are all of us temporarily disabled. If you've chosen to listen to the show, then you probably are well aware of that. But I don't feel that it's hopeless. When I was told about 3 weeks ago that the government had stonewalled post-viral disease, had shut down my idea of a case study, I'm not even asking you to make a policy, just do some science. Why is this working? How is it working? Can we do something better? They wouldn't even do that. And I had about 45 minutes where I just melted down. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, you can melt down. You can't afford the energy for this. Or you can just say, all right, I'm going to put my big girl underpants on and I'm going to start this human rights case, even though I hate that kind of conflict, even though I don't have the energy and I can't stay alive for it. And I'm going to hope that a whole bunch of other people, individuals, are going to do little things, because little things are big things. In the 20 years that I did community building, I was able to achieve things other people couldn't, because little things are big things. And so, like, sharing my story, sharing this episode, Liza, when she set up the GoFundMe, that's my friend, I was like, no one has money to give to a GoFundMe. And she said, if 10,000 people donate $5, that's $50,000, and that gives us time. You know, is it writing to the big news organizations, CBC, CTV, you know, so that there is a larger pool of people who could donate to the GoFundMe? Because I was told that when you get like a dozen people writing about the same story, they'll start telling the story. Little things are big things. So we're talking about big, scary, But we can change it. I have proved in my community building you can do things no one else can do. So I don't want this to be a story of despair. I am not viewing it that way, even though, yes, it's absolutely brutal that I don't know if I'm going to stay alive. This past year, I didn't know from month to month or week to week whether I was going to get to stay alive. And there is a brutality to that. But I also know that if I don't fight as hard as I can, that other people will suffer my same fate. Not just long COVID, but other persons with disability on assistance. And so I fight for me. I'm putting my oxygen mask on, but I know in doing so, I am fighting for other people.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely have thought a lot about a lot of the tribulations and trials that you would have to do to get a human rights lawyer. And just there are so many aspects as to how you are A, fighting for your own life, B, kind of fighting for this greater community and greater cause.
Which is everyone. And that's the thing. Yeah. It's not just people who currently have disabilities. COVID-19 is one of the worst viruses for post-viral disease I've ever seen. People who seem to be fully recovering, doctors are reporting they're seeing brain damage and heart damage. There's worries about early onset dementia. We need to get ahead of post-viral disease, so we have treatments. Mm-hmm. So for me, I look at it like the whole of my Canadian society. I don't have to like you to not want you to experience the brutality that I've experienced. And yes, of course, it's most acutely if you are a person with a disability on assistance or if you do suffer from a disease that afflicts women at higher rates than men. But to me, it's my whole darn country, you know? Mm-hmm. And maybe just the population of the world, because we are a leader.
Yeah.
But we're not. Sorry, I tapped on it.
No worries.
But we are thought to be a leader. Mm-hmm. And until we self-recognize that we have dropped the ball here, that MAID is really highlighting this discrimination, you know, what's going to happen to us? Because I keep hearing the word eugenics bandied around. But, dude, this has been going on. I've been on PWD assistance for 25 years. I've had post-viral disease for 43. I have never seen any appreciable movement in either. So what are we going to do? It's the little things. I'm willing to lift my voice up, but I need other voices. I can't just keep doing this by myself. I need other voices with me.
We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll be discussing something that we've touched on a little bit actually already, but we'll be discussing bias in the medical systems and also in research.
Are you looking for ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder. But if you take me in your arms, be confident. I commit a
character fraud. The AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre, the SASC, is a free and confidential service which provides support to those who experience sexual assault, intimate partner violence, and harassment. We provide services to folks of all genders, including students, staff, faculty, and those who have a connection to the UBC Vancouver campus. We provide crisis and short-term emotional support, legal, medical, and campus-related advocacy, and outreach and educational programs. We are located in the Student Nest, room 3130. For more information on our hours of operation and other resources and services, please go to our website, amssasc.ca. Or visit our Facebook page, AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre.
Hi, welcome back. This is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by the Accessibility Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. So, trigger warning for this episode, it contains potentially triggering content regarding medical assistance in dying and also death. So welcome back, Madeline. Hello.
Thank
you.
Hi.
Actually, you might want to. Yeah, there we go.
There we go.
Perfect. Thank you. So we've touched a little bit about this in our the past bit of this episode, but I would like to talk a little bit more in depth about acknowledging the bias in the medical systems and research. Yeah. So we already talked about how doctors are not exempt from that bias. Once again, we are feeling machines that think.
We are indeed.
And nobody is exempt from those biases that we inherently have, that we experience and see and continue to take into our lives and our careers. So kind of just acknowledging some of the biases in the medical system, there are things like gender, race, sexuality, disability. So a study done by some researchers in the UK, I believe, Chloe Fitzgerald and Samia Hurst, there was a psychological study done that proves that healthcare professionals have the same implicit biases as the rest of society to factors such as like weight, race, age, gender. And these biases mean that lower quality of care and consideration are definitely possible. Do you personally feel that your experiences with doctors and researchers, I don't know if you have any experiences with researchers.
The bias is so profound that no, I haven't been linked with researchers. And it's like, I think it might be best for me to describe what an actual experience is like, because it can feel very amorphous. So after the second round of mono, I was lucky, or I don't know, unlucky, but lucky enough that an article had come out that said that Epstein-Barr virus can instigate ME. Because it's really hard to even get diagnosed. That's how bad the bias is. And so she sent me to an internist because she thought, well, this is logical. I'll send her to an internist. And that internist basically pretty much patted me on the shoulder like I was a labradoodle and told me to be less stressed.
Sorry, when you say internist, do you mean an intern?
Yeah.
Okay,
internal medicine.
Okay, I see.
It's a kind of doctor that kind of is supposed to deal with a catch-all of things.
Yes. Yes. Internal medicine. Yes.
Yes.
Thank you for clarifying.
No, yeah,
continue.
Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
But that is the experience that people with these diseases, and I want to be clear, gender bias does not just afflict women.
Mm-hmm.
If your disease is gender bias, regardless of your gender expression, you're not getting care. So I spoke to some long COVID males. Because, the long COVID women, we're talking about like how they're just dismissed right out of the gate. Just be less stressed. Just, graded exercise therapy for ME is one of the single worst thing you can do. It's something they do for depression. And so to do it with a mitochondrial disorder can be deadly. And yet that is still pushed. And so these men were saying like, yes, while we are taken more seriously at the beginning, the result of the abdication is exactly the same. While ME does have a cognitive facet, what they euphemistically refer to as brain fog, which is the brain not having enough energy to do its job. It's like if a drunken librarian was wandering around a decrepit library trying to find information. That's what it feels like. These dismissive experiences, sufferers because it's a traumatic experience at the hands of medicine, they term it being gaslit. But gaslighting implies intent. And so if you don't understand the Semmelweis reflex, if you don't understand we're feeling machines that think, it's very easy to get into combative situations versus like, dude, we have to build communication bridges. You have to start having anti-bias training in medical school. That's not happening. None of that's happening. You have to start talking about, as I was sailing off a cliff, as I was running out of money, and I had doctors say like, oh, well, the system can't help you with everything. And I'm thinking like, not helping me with anything. And I started telling them how much money I was receiving. None of them knew how much money I was receiving. Like none of them knew that the suggestions they were making, I had no chance of doing. And there is a John Oliver of the Last Week Tonight. Mm-hmm. They did a segment about race and gender bias in medicine that has like horrific stats. So I am a paler person, but I feel like it's really important to acknowledge that women of color and people of color with these diseases, I don't even think they're being diagnosed. I think the level of dismissal is so high. But until we stop taking our doctors, stop putting our doctors on pedestals, because pedestals are wonderful things to fall off of. It's a very stressful place to put somebody. Until we start, and I say physicians, what I mean is actually allopathic physicians, because that's what's covered under MSP. And until we start training them to be patient-based versus physician-based. So if you don't arm a physician with the information and they are physician-based and they tend to turn it back on a patient, they don't know there has been some research, and so maybe they should be focusing on that. Or they're like, no, I have to fit into these boxes. It's like, well, my disease doesn't fit into your boxes because you don't have a category of coverage and you haven't done research. So you have to stop adhering to those because they don't include me. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question very well.
No. You definitely answered the question and then some. I'd like to come back to those points, but something I want to go back to is kind of the gender bias.
Yes.
And how I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you touched on a point where gender bias in research and medicine doesn't just affect women.
No.
It definitely affects anyone of any gender expression. But especially, this is like a little bit of a convoluted way to say it. But for example, ME sufferers are in the 70 to 75% of them are women.
Correct.
And because of that, there is less research, less studies, less diagnoses for ME. Yeah. And as a result, everybody else who does not identify as a woman also suffers because of that. That is something I wanted to touch on.
And it's even, okay, so look at the Epstein-Barr virus.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big one for post-viral disease. It's always been 11% of the population, and it's an endemic virus, develop post-viral disease from Epstein-Barr. Now, we now know that MS, a huge population of multiple sclerosis, is instigated by Epstein-Barr virus. So abdicating on this, not creating a vaccine, is the direct reason that I became disabled. They should have been a vaccine when I was a child for Epstein-Barr virus. It would have meant I never developed immune deficiency, never developed autoimmune disorders, never got a second round of it, and never ended up disabled. Like, there's a lot of cause and effect. There's a lot of dominoes that go on. And, if we look at 10% of the Canadian population, that's about 3.8. So 25 to 30%. Not women is a pretty big percentage of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, absolutely. It affects everyone and it affects policies. It actually directly, my disease, post-viral diseases, directly affected pandemic policy because you've got Scientific American, you've got Forbes magazine dubbing this a mass disabling event. But because my disease has been so abdicated on, and a bunch of them, again, psychosomatosis, and maybe 2% actually understood the disease. So you didn't have the guidance for the government for the policies because, you know, it's that whole, there was an old lady who swallowed a fly. Why I swallowed a fly. And then she swallows a horse. Like, I mean, if you didn't swallow the fly, if you didn't swallow the gender bias, then we would be saving massive amounts of money.
Yeah.
We would be keeping talent in our population. We would be keeping people alive.
There is funding allocated by the Government of Canada to further research ME and CFS, but it's hard to tell if it's being used or allocated appropriately.
With ME, pre-COVID, it was $140,000 a year. Now, this is in comparison to comparable diseases that have $10 million a year, like MS or AIDS. During COVID, it went up to $240,000 because physicians like Anthony Fauci were saying that long COVID looked like ME. And now, for the next 2 years, they're receiving $700,000, so like $1.4 million for 2 years. So we're nowhere with mm-hmm. that. You know, like that's kind of like the money you find in the couch cushions. That's the version of research money. It costs $500,000 a year for one specialist. So I love that they're trying to do something with it. But until we have the larger medical community standing up and going, this is not acceptable. It is not acceptable for my patients to deteriorate. It is not acceptable for them to become disabled. And I want to talk about the power of a medical provider. Years ago, when, again, that same political party came into power, and I'm not naming them because all of them are failing, but they came into power and they took a whole bunch of supports away from persons with disability on assistance. There was one podiatrist, just one, who kicked up the most unholy stink and got orthotics brought back. Just one. And this is what I talked about in a previous segment. We have power. We have power. But there is this larger hierarchical kowtowing going on within our allopathic medicine that does not serve us. They're not being encouraged to do critical thinking. They're not being taught about the Semmelweis reflex. They're not being taught Antonio Damasio's "We're feeling machines that think." Mm-hmm. And we must do that because it will attract more physicians, mm-hmm. but it will also ensure that huge, vast proportions of our society stay connected, yeah. stay contributing.
One more thing, sorry.
No, continue.
I wanted to circle back on, and I think it's important to highlight, you mentioned how a lot of physicians have no idea how much money you're getting, mm-hmm. and a lot of things they're suggesting you're not financially capable to access those yeah. things. And so I'm curious of like what are some of the suggestions?
So the Complex Chronic Diseases Clinic, and I laud them for being the only one of their kind as far as I can figure out in Canada, definitely in BC. It's an education clinic. You know, I deem it as a, you know, ME 101. If you've got mild, moderate, I didn't receive help I needed there. I've been at this for 43 years. I knew most of it, but I do think they're doing good work. They made suggestions like you must have housekeeping. You must have housekeeping. You must save energy everywhere. You must have pre-made meals. And this mm-hmm. is the diet we want you to have. You must have your laundry done. They made suggestions of about $200 to $300 worth of supplements that they had sort of vetted. You know, they actually have one of the few places that have a naturopath on staff who understands, you know. But they are not liaising with the government to say, we are a hospital clinic. We are a BC Women's. We are making these suggestions to patients who cannot afford it. And still there's not even, so we have a hospital clinic and we still don't have a category of coverage under MSP. And what that means is they can't help me in the health division. So what it's like dealing with the bureaucracy is a lot like having a very earnest cat repeatedly bringing me a dead mouse. And often the same dead mouse. And it's like, if you can't self-recognize that bias yeah. has intruded on even creating a category of coverage, then how is this supposed to help me? Mm-hmm. And so we are looking at the general public having to speak up and say, this is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for elaborating.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Catch 22 situation.
It is, but it's all over the place. Like, I actually said to one physician, they've done studies, physicians who understand what supports are available for persons with disability on assistance versus and how to apply for them versus who don't, the quality of life of those of patients are dramatically. So I said to a doctor, yeah. you guys have your conferences all the time. Why don't you reach out to the social development and poverty reduction bureaucrats and ask them to come and teach you? She's like, oh, that's a great idea. I'm like, why is it my idea? Why isn't this insistent?